Hello, we're back after a short hiatus. In this special edition of the Another Europe podcast, we launch Trade Secrets, a new book from Nick Dearden, Director of Global Justice Now and regular contributor to the show. His book is an essential read for opponents of the Brexit project. It warns of the dangers an American trade deal represents to our consumer rights, our food and farming standards, and not to mention the NHS. Zoe Williams talks to him about the corporate logic underlying the global trade and financial system and how we can transform it. So not only stop the US trade deal, but build an alternative progressive model for how our international economy works. Hope you enjoy it.
The United States is committed to a phenomenal trade deal between the US and the UK. There is tremendous potential in that trade deal.
The entire economy would, in a trade deal, all things that are traded would be on the table.
Which includes healthcare.
I would think so.
Is there chlorine in the chicken you eat?
Why would you ever want to eat a chicken that's been kept in those sorts of conditions?
Hi, Nick, and hi, everybody. I loved your book, but I also found it very worrying and depressing. And I thought maybe we could break down in the first instance, because there are a number of different areas which are kind of cause their own specific worries, and they've all got certain kinds of language attached to them. So I wonder if you could talk in the first instance about agriculture, food standards, and all those phrases that people might use in a Tory press conference that you might not necessarily know what they mean, like science-based approach or precautionary principle. So, you know, say you are Donald Trump, or say you are an American chicken producer, or say you are a British pork farmer. What would your interests be and what would your anxieties be?
Yeah, right. And it's really important, I think, to talk about the language as well, because, of course, a lot of this language sounds either reasonable or just completely impenetrable. And so getting to the bottom of what this actually means for us is really important, because these things really affect the food we eat, or, you know, the other things we're going to talk about in this call. But you can't always tell how from the language that sounds really nice. And one of the really nice phrases that's used in trade deals these days is regulatory harmonization or regulatory cooperation, which sounds great, doesn't it? But actually, what that means is putting in place processes which give big corporations absolutely enormous powers over the type of regulations that governments find themselves able to pass. And interestingly, the thing that I think has really upset people or concerned people or worried people here and throughout Europe is food standards, as you say. So food standards are a really easy shorthand, I think, to explain what regulatory cooperation and harmonisation means. And also to get us away from the idea that trade deals are all about lowering tariffs. Right? So there's this old-fashioned idea of trade, of free trade, which is all about make tariffs as low as possible, and then your goods will be, you know, produced in the most productive and efficient economy, and we will all benefit from the cheap prices that flow from this. And actually, modern trade deals aren't much to do with tariffs, especially between developed countries. So modern trade deals are all to do with what are known as non-tariff barriers. And by non-tariff barriers, we normally mean regulation. And the idea behind this is, you know, say I produce pigs for meat in the United States. I want to import my pigs into the British market, but I'm not able to because the type of chemicals I use are banned in the British market at the moment, or the type of processes I use, you know, keeping pigs in very, very confined spaces, are not allowed at the moment within the British market. So if my government goes off to do a trade deal, I lobby them because I say, look, as part of this trade deal, I want to be able to sell my goods into the British market. I believe it's protectionist that all of these kind of standards and regulations are levied on those goods. And so you need to get rid of them. And they try and get rid of them through this process of regulatory cooperation. And what this basically means is, let's say that the both goods, your pork is the same as our pork, it's equivalent. You might not make it in exactly the same way, but it's just as safe, it tastes the same, blah, blah, blah. And so essentially under this trade deal, that's an equivalent product and it will be allowed into your market. Now, okay, that might be an acceptable thing to say if products really are equivalent, but the one thing we found out over the last 5 years is how very, very different the American agricultural market is from the British agricultural market or the European agricultural market. And the extent of intensive farming, the intensive use of chemicals, the amount of genetically modified products in American food, and how that forms a majority of American foodstuffs. And that is completely different to the standards and regulations and processes that we have here. So under regulatory cooperation or harmonization chapters, which just sounds like it should be a really nice thing, what you're essentially doing is harmonizing two products that are not equivalent. And in that way, you are bound to put downward pressure on regulations and standards and protections. Because if I'm a farmer here and I'm producing to higher standards, I cannot stay competitive if I'm suddenly faced with, on supermarket shelves, much, much cheaper meat products that have been made in worse conditions.
A chlorinated chicken is a chicken what's been dunked in chlorine to get all the horrible germs off them. It's good, because it means farmers don't need to worry about basic levels of sanitation when the chickens are alive.
Because obviously this is a fresh anxiety for us in the wake of Brexit, but how is it that the American standards haven't managed to penetrate the European market to this point?
One of the things you'd have to say about the European Union is it did a degree of standard setting, which was really useful in certain areas. And one of them was food. You can also think about water quality, which is really, I mean, it's a famous one for us, right, because of how dirty our water was when we joined the EEC, and it's improved enormously. And so one of the things they've done is to try to create some kind of higher standard in agricultural production. And in particular, I would say two things really characterize this. One is the farm-to-fork method, so that the animal has to be accorded a degree of respect and dignity throughout its life. You have to minimize the amount of chemicals and GMOs and that kind of thing. And you can't just kind of, you know, as in the famous example of the chlorine chickens, dunk it in bleach at the end of the process in the hope of ridding it of all the germs that have accumulated. You have to accord it. Now, I'm in no way saying this is perfect, and of course it could be better. But the European Union has done a job of raising our standards to a certain level in terms of food production. And that also applies to the other important concept here, which is the precautionary principle. The precautionary principle, which states, and it doesn't always work perfectly at all, but states, at least in theory, if you're in doubt about something, you should err on the side of caution. So if you're worried about a new chemical and what the impact is going to be on the environment or human health or animals, then don't use it, essentially. Whereas in America, they have something which you mentioned at the beginning called the science-based principle. Sounds very nice again. But essentially, the science-based principle is essentially do it until it's proved to cause some real harm. And this is why the US trade negotiators and successive US governments have been so peeved with the European approach, because they say it's simply protectionist. These standards are simply about keeping our products out of your market. And of course, what we say is, no, they're not. They're really important standards if you believe in the environment, if you believe in human health, if you believe in animal welfare.
At the moment, the kind of doubtiest objection to chlorinated chicken in particular has been from supermarkets, saying we just won't stock it. When you talk about kind of consumer power and consumer power as mediated through supermarkets, do you have any kind of faith or hope in that, or do you think that really can't really resist anything?
So I think it's a really difficult one, and I'm not against, I think people should put pressure on their supermarkets, apart from anything else, because it's really helped in terms of the public debate, in terms of understanding this kind of stuff. And there was a really interesting quote, I think it was from one of the head honchos at Waitrose, who said, of course, we're not going to stock this stuff, but actually, we don't believe it should be down to the choice of the individual supermarket, because that's just going to mean rich, you know, middle-class consumers who can afford to shop at Waitrose don't buy this stuff. But if you can't, it's going to be on your supermarket shelves, and it's going to be very difficult to detect. And of course, you know, when you're faced with two chickens that maybe look the same, and one is significantly lower in price than the other one, an awful lot of people, for understandable reasons, are going to choose the one that's lower in price. And that's going to bring standards down for everybody, apart from those who can afford the kind of niche foods that are on sale in the more upmarket supermarkets. So I think it's really useful for them to come out and say, we don't want to stock this stuff, but I don't really believe it long term. And I simply don't believe it should be down to the decisions of the people who own the supermarkets. I think this is, you know, if we believe in trying to protect the environment, in trying to protect animal welfare, and in trying to protect our own health, and just have a better food system, this should be something which the government sets standards and regulations and protections around.
Chlorinated chicken, that's been kind of part of our discourse for a couple of years now, and it grabbed everybody's attention.
So this is really interesting. This goes back to the days of TTIP, really, which was the big trade deal that was proposed between the US and the European Union. Probably many people on the call would have been campaigners against that deal, but for exactly the same reasons we don't like this deal. I mean, it was very similar. And it was actually in Germany that the issue of chlorine chicken came up in a really big way. And it turned TTIP in Germany into a major public issue. I mean, and Germany was far ahead of us in the TTIP campaign. I mean, they had a demonstration against TTIP, which got 250,000 people on the streets of Berlin. So it was quite incredible. But this idea of chlorine chicken was the thing that drove it. And I don't know what it is about it. I don't know if it's just something that sounds funny or sounds particularly unpleasant. But, you know, it was something that comedians in Germany, mainstream comedians, latched onto and started talking about. And it kind of took hold in the public, hold of the public consciousness.
From what you've seen of the deals as they've unfolded so far, how far down the road is the government already?
So a long way down the road in terms of where you'd expect a trade deal to be by this time. And that's in part because there's a desperation to it. You know, they really want to do this and prove for them, this is the proof that Brexit is working. But not only that, I mean, as I argue in the book, I think for a lot of Boris Johnson's wing of the Tory party, and even more so Dominic Raab and Liz Truss and so on, you know, these are Atlanticists. They have wanted to move our economy and our society in the direction of the American economy for a very long time, because they see the American economy as a wonderful example of a deregulated, liberalized space where, you know, business can do what it wants and taxes are as low as possible, and they don't have to deal with, you know, troublesome regulations beyond a certain limit. And so for them, this was all part of why they wanted to do Brexit. So it's really, really important. And a trade deal, as I argue in the book, is a really good way of locking in some of these standards and putting that in train. So for them, this is really, it's really important to get this done as fast as possible. And so they've been negotiating. And of course, they very famously said, you know, coronavirus isn't going to get in the way. We're going to keep on negotiating as fast as we possibly can. And the interesting thing is, of course, you can do a trade deal very quickly if you just give the other side exactly what it wants. I mean, you know, the reason that trade deals take so long between the European Union and the United States, for example, is because both sides are arguing and negotiating very, very hard on their own interests. If you see a British government that neither really has the competence to do that, but also doesn't really want to do that, because precisely what it wants is this change in our regulations towards a more kind of American model, then you can do it fairly quickly. And that's exactly what we fear. So they've been negotiating rapidly. There's been a lot of negotiations that have taken place in a surprisingly short amount of time. And on some areas, I'm sure they're fairly close.
I know you were really exercised about the cosmetics, the threat to the cosmetics industry, which I was quite surprised about. You must think it's actually very dicey to have researched it as much as you have.
I just came across this, right, and I thought this would be a great thing for you to write about, which is why I've been hassling you about cosmetics for ages. But precisely because everyone's focused on food, right? And food, obviously, people are really concerned by what they put in their bodies and what they put in their children's bodies and all that kind of stuff. So obviously, people are going to be really concerned about food. But cosmetics just seems to me a really nice new front, because in the US, the cosmetics market is barely regulated at all. I mean, the stuff they put in some of their cosmetics, I mean, they put formaldehyde in hairspray and nail products. That they put all sorts of stuff which has been linked to health hazards in all sorts of cosmetics. And the most incredible example I find, is scarcely believable, is that in makeup that was marketed to children, they found asbestos. Like in quite a lot of it. And the reason for that is when you're producing talc, right, asbestos is produced in the same places. It's part of the process. And if you're not careful enough about it, if it isn't regulated enough, traces of it will end up in your cosmetics market. And the most incredible thing was the agency that regulates cosmetics hasn't really changed. I mean, has no extra power since back in the 1930s. So it basically said, look, we think this is really bad and we're warning the American consumer about this, but there's nothing we can do about it. Like, we can't even get this stuff recalled from the shelves. And so it's just a really nice example. I mean, I've spoken to American campaigners who say it's just the Wild West, you know, the lack of regulation in cosmetics. And I think this is really interesting because in the same way that you wouldn't necessarily expect that farmers would be part of a campaign that we were part of, you know, you might not expect that people who, you know, are particularly keen on cosmetics and makeup and getting their hair done would be part of the same campaign as us, but it is going to affect you. And so for me, it's just really interesting to start talking to people in, you know, hair salons and makeup salons and so on about something which is going to really affect the stuff that they enjoy using.
So I really like the definition of services in your book as things that you can't drop on your foot, anything that you can't drop on your foot. A lot of the attention has gone on the NHS and what the potential threat is of a trade deal, and basically the same anxieties that everybody had around the Lansley reforms, that as soon as you start kind of carving it off for profitability, then you introduce a profit motive into completely inappropriate spaces. Firstly, what is the threat to the NHS? How much has already happened? And how much can you see a trade deal kind of altering in the sense of what is open to American markets and what isn't?
So I would characterise the threat to the NHS as being something that will lock in and make it very, very hard to reverse some of the reforms that have already taken place. So the marketisation and the partial privatisation that have already taken place, and will speed it up. And it will do that in a couple of, I'm going to mention a couple of ways that are really important. I mean, I thought, you know, the Barry Gardiner, when he was Shadow Secretary of State for Trade, put it best in the election last year, when he said, look, the NHS isn't just a building you can sell. Nobody's saying that the day after this US trade deal is implemented, somebody's going to sell off the NHS as a whole. But it will affect it in two ways. One is through service liberalisation, like you've said. So an awful lot of trade deals nowadays are not just about selling more goods. They're about liberalising services, you know, about making service provision flow across borders as well. And when it comes to, and the NHS is a service, the NHS could be opted out of a trade deal with the US, but it's very hard to do that when we know that American multinational corporations are desperate for it not to be opted out because they want to have the right to bid for NHS contracts and so on and so forth. And so if it's in there, and it will be very hard to opt it out because it's already been partially privatised, if it's in there, what it would do is kind of lock in the contracting out of those bits of the NHS that are already contracted out. It would lock in the internal market mechanisms. And it would mean that a future government couldn't just come back and as easily revoke the Health and Social Care Act, which introduced a lot of that marketing. It would be locked in effect, in international law. I mean, that's why these things are so frightening, because they carry the weight of international law. And yes, it would be possible for a future government to get out of a trade deal, but it's not easy and it would take a long time. And so that's the real concern on services, that American multinational corporations would say, well, when this trade deal was signed, when I invested in your country, I expected to be able to bid for these services and run these services. And if they can't, or if that's changed in some ways, it violates the trade deal. It may also be that those corporations can directly challenge a government under the so-called inter-corporate court system, which we might go on to in a bit. And then the second really important thing is medicines prices. So, and you know, this was covered a bit in the election as well, but I think most people know that American pharmaceutical prices are well in excess of pharmaceutical prices in this country, although they're high here too. But I mean, in the US, you know, a lot of medicines cost, you know, I think one of the figures is about 4.5 times on average what they cost here. That poses a massive threat to the NHS. At the moment, the NHS bargains down big pharmaceutical companies through NICE. So NICE is an institute where basically it looks at cost effectiveness of a medicine being provided on the NHS. And NICE will sometimes say, no, it's not cost effective. We're not using that in the NHS. And that, of course, has a massive impact on what the pharmaceutical company will charge, because if NICE says we're not going to provide it, they would rather sell it at a cheaper price. The American government absolutely hates NICE. It says it interferes in the market. It's effectively price controlled. There was an article today in the Washington Times by a former congressman in America who basically said, you are free riding on our research and our consumers and our taxpayers through NICE, basically. So they want to get rid of it, essentially. They want to say the NHS should not have the right to bargain prices or control prices in the NHS. Can you imagine if all of a sudden the NHS, which already pays a fortune to pharmaceutical corporations in medicine prices, suddenly has to pay two, three, four times as much for new medicines? What it will mean is essentially that it will not be able to provide a whole load of new medicines, and then middle class people will increasingly turn to private healthcare where they can get hold of these medicines, and the NHS will become an American style Medicaid system, apparently, for those who really can't afford the prices of private healthcare. That's the worry.
And a lot of people are talking about ISDS in the chat function, so we maybe should square that off now. What are these kind of shadowy corporate courts, and what democratic kind of agency do we have in them?
Yeah, so the corporate court system is all part of investment. Used to be a separate thing from trade. Increasingly, trade deals have investment chapters in them. And this is really important because it's all about protecting the rights of investors overseas. And by and large, when you're talking about investors, you mean really big financiers. I mean, people who are investing in your country. And it gives them a whole load of new rights. And one of the ways they lock in these rights is through a special tribunal system, a kind of parallel legal system, through which they can sue governments on the other side of the trade deal, if you like. So US multinational corporations or US investors can sue a British government and vice versa for treating them unfairly. Right. And unfortunately, treating them unfairly, I mean, these things have been around for a very long time. And originally it was, as empires were falling and we were signing investment deals with countries in Africa, Asia and Latin America, British governments were very worried that some of these governments might just seize a factory or something like that, you know, just nationalize something. That's why they're in there, to stop governments doing that. But that's been massively expanded by city law firms and corporate law firms in the last 15 years. And today, what counts as an expropriating your asset or what counts as treating you unfairly as an investor can mean virtually anything. And this is not just hyperbole. I mean, there are cases that already exist, mostly between developed countries and developing countries. So it's mostly big corporations in our country suing developing countries for putting health warnings on cigarettes or putting cigarettes in plain packaging, for stopping mining projects because they fear environmental damage. Most recently, there have been a couple of cases where the Netherlands is being sued by a German energy company for phasing out coal in 2030, and they run power plants. So like any kind of regulation you can imagine, these companies will say, you're not treating me fairly, you're expropriating my assets. I mean, the cigarette case, it was against Australia, actually, one of the countries it was against. It's absolutely incredible, because actually what Philip Morris, that makes Marlboro cigarettes, said to Australia was, when we invested in your country, we expected to make however much profit over the next 10, 20 years, whatever. If you're going to put them in plain packaging, of course, we're not going to make that profit. Therefore, you're stealing our asset in some way. Right? So the future, your imagined future profits become a kind of asset in the same way that in the old days, you know, your factory would have been one of your assets. So, you know, it's really extraordinary. And there's a really interesting example, I think, of what it could mean. So when just before the election, Labour had obviously promised to take a lot of the energy sector back into public ownership. A number of private energy companies in this country had begun to set up headquarters overseas with the express aim of suing Labour if it tried to do that when it came into office and getting compensation for it. Like not just, you know, the money that they would have paid to take it back into public ownership, but they would have argued that's nowhere near enough. We deserve far more compensation than that. And really, it puts a regulatory chill on any government doing anything. And even if the government gets away with it and manages to do what they want to do, they're left with an enormous bill and legal case at the end of it. And the really extraordinary thing is, me and you can't go to one of these investor protection tribunals. I mean, we're just ordinary people. So, you know, these literally are parallel legal systems for the super rich to challenge government regulations. And for me, there is no better example, I don't think, of the way that globalization has been used to promote and protect certain interests in the world and erode our democracies.
I just want to talk about, because you've explained before now, what British Parliament could do, because it seems really natural to all of us, you know, if
Parliament doesn't like it, then Parliament says no to it. But that's not quite right, is it?
Sadly not. So for many years, when we were in the European Union, we have been campaigning with our friends and allies across Europe to give the European Parliament more power over trade policy. And slowly, slowly, we got there. We got to a stage, especially with TTIP, where they were able to see most of the papers, and when they were able to see the government's, the European Commission's negotiating objectives, and they're able to have a vote on the end of the trade deal. And one of the reasons that CETA, the Canada-EU deal, has been so hard is precisely because of that vote in the European Parliament. And not only that, every member parliament in the European Union and some regional parliaments also got a vote on that because it was such an extensive. So, you know, lots of opportunities to influence the process. When the government brought back the powers to negotiate trade deals to Britain, it didn't transfer any of those powers to the British Parliament. So we have been wrestling in trade bills, both under May and now under Johnson, to give Parliament the power to be able to properly scrutinise the government, to be able to see and vote on their negotiating objectives, and to be able to vote on the final deal. None of those things exist. We haven't given up yet. The trade bill is going to the Lords this week or next week, and we will try and get an amendment passed there. But up to this point, they have not allowed MPs any power. That means MPs have no right to see the negotiating papers. They may see the government objectives, but they have no right to vote on it. And it's purely at government discretion. And when the final trade deal comes, they don't necessarily get a debate on it. They don't necessarily get a vote on it. Even if they do get a vote on it, they only can halt the deal for 30 days. And in any case, the government will already have implemented it by that point. So it is just a shocking lack of democracy, and from people who argue that this was all about our national sovereignty and parliamentary sovereignty for years and years now, it's really shocking. And it's particularly shocking, I think. There has been a rebellion on this. Some Tory MPs have said they're very unhappy with it and have tried to pass amendments against it. But just to see all of those Tory MPs walking through the lobby saying, no, we don't want any say over this kind of stuff, I think is absolutely absolutely shocking. So Parliament, while it is still a useful platform for us to discuss these things and make sure, you know, opposition is heard to some of these trade deals, is not an effective mechanism for stopping this or any other trade deal.
And this sounds a bit of a curveball, but what difference does it make if Trump doesn't win the next election? I mean, what are the chances of a deal with Democrats? And what would then, you know, where might that lead?
No, it's a really good question, actually, because, look, I think it's really important to say there's nothing particularly strange about this trade deal. This is how trade rules work in the modern world. The reason this is so important to us is it's very unusual for Britain to be doing a trade deal with a country much more powerful than it is. We are doing now, and therefore it would massively impact upon our society and our country. But by and large, these things exist in trade rules all the time. And therefore, you know, whoever was the president of the US is likely to be pushing for very similar stuff. I mean, they might do it, you know, they would certainly do it in nicer terms than Trump. But the threat is the same. And the threat of TTIP, remember, TTIP was being negotiated and pushed by Obama very, very hard. So there is every possibility that if Biden wins, he would continue pushing this trade deal and we would have to continue opposing it. I do think there is some possibility. Well, there are two possibilities that are a little bit more hopeful. One is simply that Biden doesn't really care about a UK trade deal, right? Because this is particularly important for Trump, because there's not much of a benefit to the US economy as a whole from doing this trade deal. For Trump, this is about weakening the European Union. That's his objective, and giving himself a quick win and making it look like he can do a good deal ahead of an election. So he has a particular interest in this that Biden wouldn't have. And that might be positive. It is also true that Biden has been talking to some of Bernie Sanders' economics people, and we don't know what he's been convinced of in those conversations. We don't know whether he would take a different approach to trade or not. But I think we would have to, you know, we have to keep our guard up and say, as far as we know, if the trade deal goes through, be it with Trump or with Biden, we would have to oppose it, because the likelihood is the corporate interests that stand behind this trade deal would be pushing exactly the same agenda, and that would be heard by whichever administration.
How much our activism can and should be linking to the pressures put on the Global South by these trade deals, which obviously has been since they habitually screw the weaker party, it's been far harder for a herder in Somaliland than it has been for a kind of segment of the NHS for many, many years.
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, we were set up as an organisation to campaign primarily on issues of the Global South. So for us, maybe it's a bit unusual to be looking specifically at a trade deal that's mostly going to be bad for us rather than elsewhere. But by doing it, I really hope that we can tell people the story of trade in a way where they really understand what some of this stuff means, and that, you know, we can then pull some of those campaigners over for when our government starts doing trade deals with southern countries, which are going to have some of these very features in, but we're going to be bullying and putting pressure on those countries to lower their standards, to hire their intellectual property. That's going to be a big one. Digital. So there's a whole new area in trade deals around big tech and giving power, more power to companies like Facebook, Amazon, Google, and so on. Bad enough for us, an absolute disaster for countries who desperately need their own tech sectors if they're going to be able to do anything without continually paying rent to these enormous beasts in the next 20 years. So yeah, we're going to need to form a real trade justice movement on that. At the moment, this has not been the main emphasis of the government. They've been desperate to do deals with other developed countries, but they are talking at the moment about a deal with Kenya, kind of rollover deal. So we're looking at that at the moment and seeing what might be in that. But yeah, I mean, look, the whole point of this from their perspective is forcing open markets in Global South countries and giving big corporations and big investors from this country as many rights and privileges as possible in those countries. And so, you know, I very much hope that as part of this campaign, we don't just think about it as, you know, we want to protect our own society and our own people. And I mean, nothing in this either, Zoe, should be taken as being anti-American. Sometimes I'm accused of being anti-American. No, there's nothing about this. Is the worst thing we could possibly do for campaigners in America who are fighting for a better regulatory system and a more democratic system is that we just give in to this model. You know, so we work with American campaigners all the time. And nothing about this either is to say we shouldn't trade with America. We have no choice but to trade with America, the biggest economy in the world. But a friend and a fellow campaigner in the US, Sharon Treat, put it very well, and I quoted her in the book. She said, this isn't about importing more American products. This is about importing the American economic and regulatory model.
I'm going to ask for your kind of, you know, in that American activist way, what do you want us all to do when we leave this book launch?
Well, obviously, you know, get the book if you've not already got the book. And if you want it signed, then let me know and I'll sign it and send it off. But I definitely have to say that one of the things you can do is join Global Justice Now. And I think that James is going to put some information in the chat around all of that. We have local groups all around the country. If you don't know where your local group is, then obviously contact the office and we can let you know if you can't see it on the website. And if you do not have one, you can always set one up. And indeed, you know, particularly because of this issue, there have been several new groups that have been set up, particularly because people really want to get their hands dirty in this trade battle and stop the US trade deal. But then hopefully link it in to other issues of global economic reform, which we so desperately need.
And you know, should we be starting riots? Should we be, is there any point writing to an MP? Is there?
Well, there is point in writing to an MP, definitely, because it's really important that politicians know that if they vote a certain way, they're going to be watched. I mean, as I said, there have already been rebellions. It's quite extraordinary with a government with this size majority so early on in its term to be getting rebellions. Almost all the rebellions so far have been on trade, either on the democracy issue or on protecting agricultural standards. So, you know, it can have an impact, even if you think, oh my God, they're a completely lost cause. But also, on the same side, if you've got a Labour MP who you think's probably pretty good on it, write to them as well, because they need to know what they're going to prioritise based upon, you know, how their constituents feel about stuff. And as I say, at the moment, I think one of the issues for the Labour front bench is not opposing the US trade deal. That's great, and they're doing that already. It's actually about thinking much more deeply about what kind of an international economy that we want. And they're going to have a really important role in the world, should they ever get into government, of putting forward a seriously different idea about that kind of international economy. So that's all really, really important. But it is also important, obviously, to get out on the streets. And we're going to be having a day of action. More information to come soon, because we've not actually decided what form it's going to take yet. So if you sign up again to the list, that James will post in the chat. You will find out all about our day of action. And I mean, I'd even say short of that, you know, one of the most important things you can do is just talk to people locally, talk to people in your workplace, talk to colleagues, talk to family, talk to friends. It is so much more effective as a campaign mechanism for you to talk to people you know than for people to hear from us in the press.
That concludes this episode of the Another Europe podcast as a special edition produced in collaboration with Global Justice Now. Usually we ask you to join Another Europe, but this time around, as you've heard, we're plugging our friends at Global Justice Now, who we've worked with very closely for many years now. Stopping this US trade deal is really critical in the months and years ahead, so we'll be looking forward to campaigning with them really hard on this. To buy a copy of the book, you can go to globaljustice.org.uk. An extended version of this podcast is available in video format on the Global Justice Now Facebook page. To find it, go to facebook.com/globaljusticeuk. Finally, Another Europe are undertaking a big solidarity push for the democratic uprising in Belarus, which is entering a really critical stage at the moment. You can find details on that in your inbox if you're signed up to our newsletter, or by contacting info@anothereurope.org. You can also catch a great event with Belarus activists on our YouTube channel. Just search for Another Europe is Possible on youtube.com. We'll be back very soon. See you then.